Well, it's been a joy so far to worship together. I've been blessed. I must confess I was wrestling a little bit coming into sharing this message, feeling, especially this morning, like something's not right with what I'm prepared to share or the way I'm prepared to share it or something. And as we had our prayer time with the ministry this morning and then came into the service and I was sitting there meditating and praying some more, I got this distinct impression that I'm being somewhat of a hypocrite. But that didn't feel quite right either. And the words that came to mind as I thought about this and wrestled with what's wrong is I really identify with the words of Romans 7. What I am doing, I do not understand. For what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, or I do. Or further down in the chapter, I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man, but I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. So as I present this message, I know what the truth is. I know what we're supposed to do. I know what I'm supposed to do, yet I don't do it. And I think that's kind of been the core of my struggle as I come into this message, because I'm talking about things I know, but I don't practice. So hopefully this can be a challenge to me and a challenge to you as well, to develop a relationship with God that goes beyond the knowledge that we have and that we're blessed with. I'm very thankful for the knowledge I have of God. But to develop a relationship that goes beyond knowledge, because knowledge isn't a relationship. Relationship is communication. Relationship is interacting and communicating. We call it prayer, but we use the word prayer so much that we think of prayer maybe more as mailing letters. Or as Michael Card put it, as he grew out of his relationship with his father, slipping letters under the door and getting no response. But prayer is intended to be much more than that. And as we go through this message, my hope is that we will be challenged to become people of prayer, relational prayer. And that might not be apparent at the beginning of the message, but hopefully it is as we go on through and look at the text. So we're going to be continuing in Matthew. I'd like to get through Matthew chapter 17 this morning, and I have way too much material, so pardon me as I do my best. I really want to get into the beginning of Matthew 18 so we can look at fun things like offenses and the eternal conscious torment debate, which some of you have no doubt heard about. If that piqued your interest, that's next Sunday. We're not going to get there. Not next Sunday, next time I preach, Lord willing. I'd like to touch on that somewhat. If you don't know what that is, that's fine. You'll find out. Just keep coming back. All right. Matthew 17, our text is verses 14 through 27. Matthew 17, 14. And when they had come to the multitude, a man came to him, kneeling down to him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic and suffers severely. For he often falls into the fire and often into the water. So I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him. Then Jesus answered and said, O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him here to me. And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, Why could we not cast it out? So Jesus said to them, Because of your unbelief. For surely I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, Move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. However, this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting. Now when they were staying in Galilee, Jesus said to them, The Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and the third day he will be raised up. And they were exceedingly sorrowful. When they had come to Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" He said, "Yes." And when he had come into the house, Jesus anticipated him, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take customs or taxes? From their sons or from strangers?" Peter said to him, "From strangers." Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. And when you have opened its mouth, you will find a piece of money. Take that and give it to them for me and you." So there's three stories in this passage, and I want to look at each one. It's going to feel a little anticlimactic, possibly, ending with the story about the money in the mouth of the fish after the dramatic first story. But I want to look at three of them. And the first two of these stories are recorded in the three synoptic gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell the story. And they all give different details. Fascinating to see their approaches and fascinating to put all the details together. When we look at it, this story of the boy that Jesus cast the demon out of is the most detailed story of a demon exorcism in the Bible. It's the most detail we have in any one story, especially when you put them all together. So I don't know how well you'll be able to read what I have up on the PowerPoint. I took the verses out of the ESV. I read them in NKJV. The ones on the screen are ESV, and there are some important differences that I want to note as we go along. But I took the verses from Matthew, Mark, and Luke and put them side by side with Matthew on the left, Mark in the middle, and Luke on the right, and spaced them out so that the verses roughly line up with the portion of the story so we can see what's happening as we go along. And I really want us to take the time and enter this story and feel what it must have been like to be there. Feel the Father's pain. To feel what Jesus is experiencing as he goes through this as well. And just kind of enter the story and look at it. You'll notice quickly that Mark has by far the most detail on this story. Matthew starts when they came to the crowd. So a fairly bland, flat, "Oh, look, there's a crowd." Luke adds the detail that it was on the next day when they had come down from the mountain that a great crowd met him. The next day after what? Well, after the previous story in Matthew and Mark and Luke, which we looked at the last time I preached, which was, does anybody remember what that story was? The Transfiguration, right. So the mountain that Luke refers to was the Mountain of Transfiguration. And they came down the next day. So they had gone up to the mountain the day before, spent the night there. Luke says they went up to pray. Remember that. That's significant later on in this message as well. And they spent the night in the mountain, and the next day they came down. Jesus and his disciples then are looking for Jesus and Peter, James, and John, who went with him, are looking for the other disciples. They're looking for the rest of their group. As we see in Mark, when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them. So all three Gospels mention the crowd, but Mark is the only one who elaborates on just how chaotic of a scene this was. There was the crowd around them, and there were scribes arguing with them. So there's the disciples, the nine, other of the 12, kind of in the center. There's the crowds mobbing around them and trying to have their input into what's going on. And then there's the scribes arguing with them. So very, very chaotic scene. And Mark also adds, immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, that is Jesus, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. So they were amazed when they saw Jesus. I've wondered already if his face was still glowing or if he was somehow changed from the transfiguration experience. I don't think that's indicated here, but it doesn't rule it out. But when they saw Jesus, they were amazed. There he is. He's the one we need. And they ran up to him and greeted him. And Jesus asked them, that is the disciples, "What are you arguing about?" So he made his way to his followers, his disciples. Rather than engaging the crowds first, he engaged his disciples. And at that point, Matthew says, a man came up to him and kneeling before him, Mark says someone from the crowd answered him. Luke says a man from the crowd cried out. And what this man said, what each writer records him as saying, gives a fascinating insight into the writers themselves. Matthew says, the man said, "Lord, have mercy on my son." The focus is on the mercy, on Jesus' compassion. The Jesus who said, "Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." That's the picture that Matthew sees here. "Lord, have mercy on my son." Mark says, "Teacher, I brought my son to you." There's action, there's movement, there's drama, because that's what Mark was focused on in his writing. And Luke says, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son," or "examine my son." Who would you ask to examine your child? A doctor, yeah. It's a doctor's word. "Examine my son." And Luke often writes with that doctor's perspective. He usually gives the most details about the symptoms as well that the sick people were experiencing, because that was his perspective. Just fascinating, the different focuses they have. Matthew records the man saying his son is an epileptic. In other words, he had seizures. And that he suffers terribly. And it can be tempting to focus on the physical aspect of epilepsy, which is a real disease, and to minimize the spiritual aspect. And some people go so far as to say that Jesus, when he related to demons, was simply engaging their primitive superstitions, and that the demonic activity wasn't actually real. This story does not bear that out. Even though Matthew gives minimal focus on the demon, whereas Luke gives more, and Mark especially gives a strong focus on the demonic aspect of this boy's condition. He suffers terribly. Mark says he has a spirit that makes him mute, so he was unable to talk. Luke says a spirit seizes him, or it grabs him. It grabs him and it won't let go. And he suddenly cries out. He shrieks. It's just terrifying to think of that kind of a shriek that must have come from him when this demon grabbed him. But he shrieks. Mark says it throws him down. And this is a very vivid acting, throwing down. It body slams him to the ground. So this was not just a collapsing because his legs gave out. This was a active throwing himself at the ground. It was a harsh, hard action. It slams him to the ground. Matthew adds, he often falls into the fire and into the water. Now Mark mentions this later and we'll get there. But he often was falling into dangerous situations, so the father had to be constantly watching, ready at any moment to spring into action and rescue his son from whatever danger he managed to find. So these seizures weren't random. The seizures were specifically targeting the boy's life. They were finding the most dangerous times and places to flare up. So the father had to be constantly on guard to prevent his son from drowning or being burned. Luke adds, it convulses him. So this was a powerful convulsion, crumpling up his body and pulling all his muscles together. Overwhelming, and it would have been terrifying to see. It shatters him, Luke says, or it bruises him. It breaks him into pieces by crushing him is the picture in the words. He foams at the mouth. He grinds his teeth. He becomes rigid. And so as the seizure came to its conclusion, he was left stiff, rigid, and unresponsive. And Luke finishes up, it will hardly leave him. So he would stay this way for some time. He would stay in this seized state, unresponsive. And so every time the father, as he watched his son go through this suffering, would have been wondering if his son was dead, if this was the time that it would be too much for his body, if his mind would be destroyed and he'd be left a vegetable. Eventually his little body would have had enough, or eventually they would have not been vigilant enough and he would have died. And every episode of this must have been torment for the father, because it was potentially the last time, potentially the one that would destroy the son. And so he says, "I brought him to your disciples," and they couldn't heal him. They were not able to cast out this demon. They could not do it. Why not? Well, we'll see as we go on here. Jesus answered, and it's fascinating. This reply of Jesus right here is the only part where Matthew, Mark, and Luke are all almost word for word in this account of the story. Jesus answered, "O faithless and twisted or perverse generation." Do you hear the exasperation in his voice? The frustration. I don't like to imagine Jesus as frustrated, but I don't know how else to read these words in all three Gospels recorded exactly like this. "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." Notice what happens as they bring the boy to Jesus. While he was coming, Luke says, the demon threw him to the ground and convulsed him. Notice the length of detail that Mark goes into in this dramatic scene. They brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. So, dramatic action happening, a dramatic seizure, very dangerous situation for the boy. You would think that this is an emergency situation. Jesus is going to immediately spring into action and heal the boy. But what does he do? He asks a question. He asks the father, how long has this been happening to him? Why did Jesus not immediately spring into action? Why did he ask this question first? Didn't he care about the boy? This is a little troubling to me. And yet this is the record that we have. How long has this been happening? What's the significance of that question? Well, the father answers it. He says, from childhood. And often, we already saw this in Matthew, but often it has cast him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. And it's been doing this from very early on in his life. The father concludes, but if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said to him, Mark 9:23, and Jesus said to him, if you can, all things are possible for the one who believes. Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, I believe, help my unbelief. It's interesting and a little troubling how again exasperated Jesus sounds when he says, if you can. But he saw, and I believe this is part of why he was asking the Father, he saw that things in the Father, in the boy's home, weren't quite right and were contributing to the suffering, to the ability of this demon to possess this boy. So, when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, that's Mark, he rebuked the unclean spirit. I think that's significant. What persuaded Jesus to act? Why did Jesus spring into action eventually? I mean, of course he loved the boy. Of course he cared about the boy. But he didn't jump into action right away when he saw the suffering. He didn't jump into action when he heard the pleas of the Father, if you can do anything, please help us. But when he saw the crowds coming running together, when he saw the commotion, that's when he healed. Usually when Jesus healed someone, he would do it with some form of the phrase, your faith has saved you. Your faith has made you whole. And there's nothing of that in Jesus' response here. Now, to the boy, the credit of the boy's father, he admitted that his faith was weak. He begged Jesus to help his unbelief. And he needed help. He needed help with his unbelief. I believe there was more work to be done in that father's heart and in their home, because there was something there that had opened the door for this demon to come into this boy at such a young age. But because of the crowds, because of the commotion, something needed to be done in that moment. Someone needed to take charge of the situation. And so Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, and I'm reading from Mark here again, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. Jesus healed the boy in spite of the lack of faith displayed by the disciples. In spite of the weakness of the father's faith. He rebuked the unclean spirit. He had no doubts about his own authority, even though he may have been frustrated with the situation and the lack of faith he was seeing in people. He spoke to the spirit directly, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And in these words, I see his compassion for the boy coming through, even though in spite of the circumstances. He couldn't say, "Go and sin no more," or "You are healed, sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you," like he did in other cases. And I think, I think there was still things in the heart of the father of this boy that were not right, and that prevented the father from being the protection that he should have been against the attacks of the evil one. As a father, he should have protected his son, fought for his son, fought the spiritual warfare for his son. But Jesus knew that if he simply cast the demon out of this boy and said nothing more, the last state of the boy would be worse than the first. And so he said, "Go out of him and never enter him again." He bound that evil spirit from ever being able to come into that boy again. And I think that gives us insight into that the protection that should have been there for this boy was not there. It's also worth noting that Jesus addressed the demon directly. He didn't speak to the father. He didn't speak to the boy. And the way he speaks shows clearly that there was another being here, another creature, if you will, an evil spirit who could hear and act, even though this demon could not speak. Many of them could, as we see in other places in the gospel, but this one could not. Jesus addresses the demon directly, but he does not address it by name. And though he says the demon was deaf, the demon obviously could hear Jesus. He gave it two specific commands which it had no choice but to obey. And so after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse. His physical body was completely exhausted. The demon had expended every ounce of his physical strength, so much so that it seems he wasn't even breathing. And so most of the people said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And Luke says, he gave him back to his father. Even though this father was imperfect, obviously, he was still the father. He was still the best one to take care of this boy over the long term. The father still loved his only son. In spite of all his failings, he was the one to care for him. And so Jesus gave the boy back to his father. And Luke says, all were astonished at the majesty of God. That's everyone. The boy's father, the disciples, the noisy crowds, and the argumentative scribes. Each one in his own way was astonished at the majesty of God. Peter, later in 2 Peter 1:16, when he was describing the transfiguration, he said, "We were eyewitnesses of his majesty." Same word that Peter used to describe what he saw on the Mount of Transfiguration is what they saw coming through here in his power over this difficult demon. They were all astonished at the majesty of God. And when he had entered the house, the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" Look at this. Mark and Matthew both record this question, but they record different responses. Obviously, the discussion between the disciples and Jesus about what went wrong here and why they couldn't cast it out was much more lengthy and much more in-depth than what we have recorded. But we have two answers. Why couldn't we cast it out? Let's look at Matthew's response first. He said to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed." What is faith? What is faith? In the words of Hebrews 1:11, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Or according to Romans 4:21, faith is being fully convinced that God is able to do what he has promised. If you have faith like a grain of mustard seed. But what is faith? Is it something that we get like a coin or like a seed that we somehow procure through searching for it? Is it something that we muster up through our own willpower? A lot of times the picture of faith we have is this inner strength that we muster up through exterminating our own doubts and focusing our willpower. That's not faith. What is it? Let's hold that question as we go through this. If you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, Mount Hermon, the one we just came down from after spending the night in prayer. That's a big mountain. It's a snow-capped mountain. If you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Now, this seems like such a ridiculous exaggeration. Why did Jesus say this? I mean, surely if it's true, and Jesus allows these words to be recorded, people are going to try, right? I mean, Mount Hermon is toast. Somebody's going to get it right after a couple thousand years. And yet, it's still there. It obstinately stays put right where it is. Mount Hermon is still there. You can go ski on it. What's going on? Well, remember who's speaking here. Remember the aspect of God that John described in the very opening part of his devotions. Psalm 8. Remember who's speaking here. This Jesus who is speaking, listen to these words, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. That's Colossians 1:15 through 17. Or how about this verse? He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. That's Hebrews 1:3. If those verses are true, the only reason Mount Hermon is staying put in the first place is because Jesus is holding it there. It's no more difficult for him to move it than for him to keep it in its place. Right? It will move and nothing will be impossible for you. So faith then, I would submit to you, is not an unwavering confidence in our own words, but an unbroken connection with the author and sustainer of the universe. Matthew 5:21 is in brackets because depending what version of the Bible you're using, it will not be there. The King James, New King James will have it. The ESV, the NIV will not. The reason is because they're based on different ancient Greek texts. One of the frustrating things about our New Testament is that there are Greek texts coming from different areas, different streams of scribes copying them, and they vary a little bit here or there. And so either Matthew 5:21 was added later, or it was dropped later from when it was originally written. It's hard to tell. Scholars spend a lot of time and energy trying to figure this out and arguing over it. I think it's likely that it was added later because we find that phrase coming in Mark. Although the mention of fasting, prayer and fasting is also bracketed in Mark. In either case, Jesus spoke these words from Mark's record. We know that he gave this as part of his answer to the disciples. So whether you put that verse there in Matthew or not doesn't change the overall meaning of the gospel record. because it is included in Mark. That's almost all cases where verses are disputed and people say the NIV is taking verses out of the Bible. It doesn't change the overall meaning when you take the big picture, and that's certainly the case here. So let's look at Mark's answer to the question, why could we not cast it out? He said to them, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer, or prayer and fasting, if you will. So that makes me ask a question. Why did Jesus not have to pray first before he cast out the demon? You know, he prayed before he raised Lazarus from the dead. He prayed publicly sometimes before working miracles, but he did not pray before he cast out this demon. Why not? He said this kind can only come out through prayer. Why didn't Jesus have to pray first? Why not? What do you think? Isn't he contradicting himself here? He's God's son. That's true, and that's certainly part of it. I would suggest, though, that he did pray before he cast this demon out. In fact, I know he did. What had happened just before this? Where had they come down from? Mount of Transfiguration. And why had Jesus gone up there? To pray. In fact, he spent a good part of the night in prayer. We know that because Luke records that Peter and James and John kept falling asleep while Jesus was praying before the transfiguration happened, and that woke him up. But he regularly spent those times alone in prayer. It wasn't that this kind couldn't come out because you needed to have a specific prayer before it happened, but this kind only comes out when there is a base of prayer, when there is a relational prayer. And he had a special connection, undoubtedly, because he was the Son of God. He was the power that Jesus had as God's Son, as God himself, was unimaginable. And yet, he made it a point, time and again, to go alone, to pray, to interact, to talk with his Father. He may have even been fasting while he was on the mountain. We don't know. It doesn't say. But he regularly spent hours at a time alone with God in prayer. The disciples, meanwhile, slept. Their faith was weak, and so was their authority, because their prayer was weak. And our prayers are often weak. Not because we don't say the right words, but because we don't have the connection with God that only comes through regular extended times of prayer. Our faith is weak and ineffective, not because we lack the willpower to defeat our doubts, but because we lack prayer. And could it be that the reason we don't regularly see miracles is not because we're asking incorrectly, but because we're not people of prayer, people of relational, conversational prayer? Many people try to build models, methods for exorcising demons from taking stories like this. Try to make methods, but the key to successful spiritual warfare isn't a method, it's a relationship. The key to exercising authority is being under authority. Spiritual discernment. Sometimes we can't tell the difference between physical diseases and spiritual warfare or spiritual maladies, and the lines are often blurry. I'm well aware of that. But the discernment to know how something should be approached, even the spiritual discernment, isn't a method to be mastered. It's the result of a relationship. And the more time we spend communicating with God through prayer, speaking to Him, listening to Him, the better we will learn to know His voice. And as we learn to know His voice, we begin to hear Him directing us in the spiritual battles we face. And as we put ourselves under His authority, He delegates that authority to us so we can defeat every demon and tear down every stronghold. Only through relationship with Him. But don't forget that the goal of developing a relationship with God is not to access the power or the authority. The relationship is the goal. The power and authority is a gift He joyfully gives us. to those who take the time to listen enough to learn to know his voice. Two more stories yet, and we're almost out of time. As they were gathering in Galilee, and Mark adds, he didn't want anybody to know where they were, for he was teaching his disciples, saying, the Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day. Luke says he started this with, let these words sink into your ears. Let this sink down into you and become a part of you. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. Of course, the disciples knew him well enough to know he was talking about himself. And they will kill him, he says. Now, isn't it ironic? Jesus has just said, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, nothing will be impossible for you. And now he's saying he himself is going to be captured and killed. Surely anybody with even a mustard seed-sized portion of faith would be able to prevent his own execution. Surely if we have faith, all we need to do is pray, and we will be able to escape suffering, overcome disease, and live comfortable, prosperous lives. Surely. This is the message that often gets preached out of verses like, nothing will be impossible for you. And yet, here is Jesus, the very one who makes the impossible possible, telling them that he's going to be defeated by mere men. What's going on? Well, what's the purpose for Jesus' life? What is Jesus' greatest moment of glory? The purpose for his life was to die a ransom for many, was to give his life on the cross and rise again. He was telling them his very purpose. Let us never lose sight of the beauty of the paradox that in his defeat, his greatest victory was accomplished. His greatest glory was in his humiliation, and his unthinkable suffering yielded unimaginable joy. And this same paradox, I think, is true of us, of his followers. Our greatest beauty comes out of ashes. Our fullest joy comes out of our darkest emptiness, and our sweetest peace is born of trauma. He who loses his life will find it. It's not that God wills us to suffer. It's not that God wants us to suffer or that God tempts us. James says he cannot do that. And yet there can be no resurrection without death. And his goal, his destiny for us, for which he has foreordained us, is resurrection. There can be no resurrection without death. And Jesus says he will be raised on the third day. He's been telling them this over and over and again by now. Peter said, not so, Lord, may this never happen to you. And got told, get thee behind me, Satan. Jesus said it again as they were coming down from the mountain of transfiguration, and they were confused. They had no idea what he meant by the resurrection from the dead. And he says it here again. But they did not understand. They were afraid to ask him, and they were greatly distressed. Are there sayings of Jesus that we don't understand? Are there things in the Bible that we don't understand? Yeah. Are we afraid to ask? Often we are. We're afraid to ask. We're afraid what his answer might be. We're afraid of the silence. Because it hurts. It hurts to not know. It feels like he doesn't care. But he says, let these words sink into your ears. One more story. We're almost done. The money in the mouth of the fish. So the temple tax here, it was a half shekel. This tax goes all the way back to Exodus. Every male 20 years and older had to pay half shekel for the support of, at that time, the tabernacle, then for the maintenance of the tabernacle, then for the maintenance of the temple. This was not a mandatory tax. It wasn't that it was enforced by the government. So it wasn't enforced, but it was expected. It was shameful not to pay the temple tax. It seems that the tone of the tax collectors, that they approached Peter, they were maybe more embarrassed. They didn't want to shame Jesus. because his tax was very late. If the timetable from the commentary I read was right, the tax was due in our month of March. But Jesus had been traveling, had been out of the area quite a bit during this summer, and so it was nearly August or September. His tax was about 6 months overdue. Embarrassing. And so they went up to Peter, maybe because Peter was kind of the leader. They didn't want to actually approach Jesus and shame him. Possibly, and this comes from a message Daryl Petersheim preached here a couple years ago, it's possible that Jesus and Peter were the only ones of the entire group who owed the tax, because Peter, aside from Jesus, was the only one who was over 20, and the rest of them were still teenagers. That's a possibility with the way the Jewish rabbi schools worked, at least if Daryl's research on that was correct. At any rate, it seems that Peter and Jesus were the only ones who owed the tax. And so they ask Peter, does your teacher pay the tax? And he says, yes. He wants to make things okay. Yeah, we do that. And then he goes back to the house and is thinking, how am I going to ask Jesus this? This is awkward. This is embarrassing. We don't have any money. And he walks into the house, and before he can get a word out, Jesus says, Jesus spoke to him first. So before Peter could even get a word out, Jesus says, what do you think, Simon? From who do the kings of the earth take toll or tax? Jesus literally read Peter's mind as he came into the house. Of course, we know Jesus could do that, but it's still interesting to note there how dramatically he read his mind. From whom do the kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others? And when he said from others, Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. So the temple was his father's house, right? He knew that from the time he was a little boy. So he didn't owe the tax. And yet, he says, we don't want to offend them. So, go cast a hook. This is the only time in the New Testament a fish hook is mentioned. They usually fished with nets. But apparently they had fishing hooks and I don't know about rods and sinkers and bobbers and all that. But go cast a hook in, and the first fish you catch, look in its mouth. You'll find a shekel. The tax due was a half shekel. You'll find a whole shekel in the mouth of this fish. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself. Matthew doesn't bother to finish the story. Mark would have dramatically told exactly what happened because he loved the action. But Matthew doesn't bother to finish the story. The implication is obvious. Peter acted in faith. He did what Jesus said. And things happened exactly as Jesus predicted. Do we trust God to provide for our needs? What does that look like, to trust God to provide? Does it mean we go fishing every time we can't pay a bill? Obviously not. It would be kind of nice, though. But Peter had no trouble trusting Jesus and acting on this trust because he knew Jesus. He knew his voice. And so we return to the same theme that we've seen through the other stories. Effectively trusting Jesus to provide for our needs looks a lot like the kind of life that empowers us to cast out demons. Peter was Jesus' friend. Peter knew Jesus' voice. He spoke with him often. If we are people of prayer, if we spend time in conversation with God, if we learn to know his voice, we will be able to act on his instructions and trust him to provide for our needs. It certainly means talking to God and taking the time to listen to him. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for these stories. Thank you for the power that you manifested, Jesus, as you were here on earth. Thank you for the promises. Lord, help us to trust you, to trust your promises that you will provide for our needs, that you ransom us from sin, and that you delegate your authority to those who know you through prayer. Lord, help us to become people of prayer. Help us to become people of conversational prayer, people who talk to you. And even more than that, people who listen to you, who learn to hear your voice, learn to know your voice, learn to know the sound of your voice. Thank you for your word that guides us, that is our map. Your word in the Bible that is an unchanging constant, guiding us into all truth. And thank you for the Holy Spirit that interprets the truth to us and speaks into our hearts and to our spirits. Help us, Lord, to become people of prayer, to be still before you, to know that you are God, and to hear your voice. In Jesus' name, amen.